Blog Talk Radio.
This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, on Thursday, April the 23rd, and an absolutely beautiful spring-like day here in North Texas. The only thing missing, of course, is the baseball season. That's the only thing that we do not have. But other than that, it's just an absolutely lovely day. We want to say hello today to our friend Richard Baer. Richard, of course, one of the co-founders of American Thinker and a great friend of our show and someone who we usually go to when we want to talk about something important. But Richard, I don't have any baseball to ask you about. Nothing about the Cubs or the White Sox today.
Well, the only good news is that this is the latest in the season that both the Cubs and White Sox are tied for their division lead on the same day.
Maybe a Windy City World Series.
If the game is played.
Yeah, a Windy City World Series. Both teams have a 0-0 record. And they meet in the World Series. But it is weird, I mean, to say the least, not to have baseball at this point. Of course, not just baseball. By now, the NHL playoffs would be going, the NBA playoffs. So it's so strange, you know. Every once in a while, I tune in MLB.com, and they've got these old games, which are fun to watch. They're fun to watch, but they're not as fun when you know the end. You know, when you know the ending of the game, they're not as fun to watch, you know.
I mean, sports fans are definitely going through a tough period. The ESPN premiered the series documentary on Michael Jordan on Sunday night.
Yes.
And they got the highest ratings by far they've ever gotten for a documentary series. And my guess is whatever this NFL draft looks like from people's basements tonight, there'll be more people watching it than ever watched it before.
Yeah, I think President Trump is right when he says people want to get out. And not just physically, but they just want to be able to have some of their life back. I mean, you don't realize how much you miss it, I guess, until you don't have it. Maybe that's the story. That's the story of it. But let me ask, before we're going to talk about the blue states and the talk of bailing out or bankruptcy for some of these states, but I want to ask you in general what you think of these briefings. There was another one today. And I thought today, you know, he gets into fights with CNN, and I go back and forth on that because sometimes I say, why is he getting into a fight with a station that nobody watches? But then on the other hand, I put myself in his place. I mean, he knows how much work is going into this, all the effort that is going into this, the hundreds or thousands of people who are working behind him. You know, we will never know their names, but they're heroes nevertheless. And it seems like all you hear in these press conferences, not all, but a lot of them, it's just negative, Richard.
No, there's a pretty intense case among the Washington correspondents who cover the White House of Trump derangement syndrome. And everything is viewed from an electoral prospect. November is just a little over 5 months away now, 6 months away. And that matters to them as much or more than anything else they might be asking about. If it can portray Trump in a negative light and prove embarrassing in some way, sometimes even provoke him to get him angry. But it's designed simply to create ill will towards the administration because the media at this point are with the exception of a very few exceptions, are pretty solidly in the pocket of the Democratic National Committee. They're an arm of the Democratic National Committee. And unfortunately, from my perspective, I think Trump sometimes sort of invites them to do what they do because he has that New York attitude of never taking anything. If he thinks he's being abused or mocked, he has to hit back twice as hard. And people who are watching these programs by and large, I think, are looking for information. And the thing that Trump did best was put Pence in charge of this, just like the best decision he probably ever made was to make Pence his vice president. I don't think he could have been elected without Pence as VP. And Pence has done a workmanlike job. He has gathered the people. They've made adjustments as the data changes. They have, as like you pointed out, a tremendous number of people who are working to get materials to the states, whether it was the personal protective equipment, whether it was ventilators, when everyone thought ventilators were going to be the item in need. Now people are fading away from ventilators because it looks like there are more illnesses associated with the heart at this point, even than just traditional pneumonia that's you deal with a ventilator. And almost everybody put on a ventilator has died. So that approach hasn't worked by and large. But that was the big issue, was they were going to do, there was going to be this shortage of vital equipment. There wouldn't be enough ICU beds. There wouldn't be enough hospital beds. There wouldn't be enough ventilators. And that's what his team has done, as they've moved things around. They bought things into the country. They've gotten companies that are not producing what they normally do to produce what's required for the hospitals and the patients. And if anybody thinks this is an easy thing to do, to turn an economy on a dime, to start essentially mass-producing items that are required for something you didn't expect to happen. And, you know, there's plenty of criticism that we should have had preparation time. I look at the numbers for the countries in Europe. They have the same preparation time we did. Their numbers are similar to ours, or worse, actually, as far as death rates. And everybody had the same amount of warning, and almost nobody outside of maybe South Korea and Taiwan seems to have really blocked this off and been able to keep it to a confined population. So what you have is a lot of fencing in these things, but people are watching it for the information, and they are getting that. The people who are on Pence's team, Dr. Birx, Fauci, Redfield, I mean, you're getting information, and people who want to actually find out what's happening will find out through these conversations. But the Q&A, unfortunately, you know, is a kind of sparring that seems to happen anytime this president shows himself on television in the presence of a reporter.
Yeah, but a lot of it, I mean, some of the questions are interesting. I mean, like, if they want to find out, I mean, some of the questions are interesting, but a lot of it is like, on the 22nd of February, you said this.
Sure.
I mean, I think those kinds of questions, they kind of remind me a little bit of you know, the questions that the topics that we used to get after 9/11, you know, that Bush somehow was supposed to know that three airplanes were going to hit the buildings that morning.
Yeah, everybody's a tremendous decision maker in hindsight.
Right. Yeah, everybody's an expert, you know, after, to use a baseball analogy, after you give up a three-run homer, everybody knows you shouldn't have thrown that pitch. I mean, it's just remarkable to me how everybody's an expert after the fan. I mean, after the crash or the accident, Richard.
Right. I mean, the Democratic House Committee that Adam Schiff chairs is going to have an investigation of our preparedness and what we did wrong. And clearly that'll produce some report that they'll try to have out right before the election so they can blame Trump for excess deaths that were unnecessary. And I mean, this is unfortunately the nature of politics at this point. One of the things that was, even 19 years ago in 2001, after those attacks in New York City and the Pentagon and the plane that hit down in Pennsylvania, there really was kind of a moment of national unity. I mean, Bush had been elected, 10 months earlier with less than 50% of the vote. The country had been divided politically, and yet people were on the same team because they understood we'd been attacked and we had to have a national response. And then, and people, wherever they were sympathetic to the plight of people who had been in New York or New Jersey who never came home and what happened to their families and the firemen and the police. We're just in a different era right now. I mean, we had an election in 2016 that a significant part of the population never accepted the results. And that has led to this kind of resistance mentality. And unfortunately, we're in a situation now which is in some ways unprecedented. We've never had a country choose to shut down significant parts of its economy for the purpose of protecting a portion of the population that's particularly vulnerable to this kind of virus. And those actions, rather than people sort of inquiring about how to make the operation better, be more efficient, how can they help, it's more accusatory.
Right.
And again, if someone's looking for statements people made that were inappropriate, or they, at the time they said them, in retrospect, they probably should have, you know, they would have thought about not saying them. There's nobody perfect in this. Dr. Fauci said things in January and February suggesting he didn't think this was going to be a crisis of the kind it was. Trump downplayed it for a while, but at the same time, he did put in place this task force, which has been operating well before they had these press conferences and these and these daily meetings. So it wasn't like they were unaware. But given the lack of information that came out of China, the months that were wasted because of the deception by China and the World Health Organization, it's not surprising that people were behind the eight ball when they finally got, you know, to the kind of responses that you saw beginning the last week or two.
Yeah, I agree. No, I agree. I mean, I remember, again, comparing it to 9/11, how quickly and how efficiently the Bush administration handled that. I mean, as soon as the 9/11 attack happened, we didn't get hit again, and we didn't get hit again in large part because of the tremendous effort that Bush and Cheney and that team put together. But I agree with you. This is really nasty, what we're watching, and excuse me, very nasty what we're watching, and it's just not pleasant.
They're rooting the country to fail. They would prefer the country fail if they get the electoral result they won in November, which is kind of incredible given what we're dealing with.
Right, and what's interesting about that, because I've had conversations with people who actually, they don't actually come out and tell you that, but you know that's what they're really saying.
Mm-hmm.
They're saying, you know, I want Trump to lose the election so badly that I'm willing to to have these things really get worse than they are, you know. And I always say, but okay, so let's say he loses the election and your guy comes in. Do you think that he's going to be inheriting a better situation? Because, I mean, the fact is that no matter who wins, and that's part of the topic we're getting into now, but no matter who wins in November, I certainly hope it's Trump, and I believe it's going to be Trump. I really feel that way. But no matter who wins, we're inheriting a very tough financial situation.
Oh, yeah.
There are states in the union right now, your state of Illinois, New York, Connecticut, New Jersey, just to name four, and I think California too, although we're not talking about them as much. States that have really serious financial situations, they've exported a lot of their taxpayers, and now they got to rebuild those states, and they don't have the tax base to do it because, you know, the taxpayers have left those states. And now they're saying, well, gee, we need money from the federal government, and a lot of you have the words of the majority leader saying, no, it's better to have bankruptcy. So,
and exactly in response to what you just said, a couple interesting things. Illinois, where the head of the Democratic-controlled state senate wrote a letter to the two U.S. senators from Illinois, Dick Durbin and Tammy Duckworth, asking for, in the next stimulus bill, that there be $40 billion sent to Illinois to cover financial problems caused by COVID-19, but also on the side, how about $10 billion to put our pension plan in a little better shape, because the pension plan in Illinois is the 48th most solvent in the country. And you have to think about that. It says a state has put itself essentially behind the eight ball, put itself in desperate financial condition with all the decisions they made before COVID-19 occurred, before this crisis. And now they want, as part of some sort of relief, and I expect there'll be some sort of relief for the states that will come, that will be parceled out on some rational basis, but to solve or to force the rest of the country to solve the problems of a few states that have been the worst fiscally managed in the country. In Illinois, you can't change the pension plans of existing employees or those already retired without a constitutional amendment. Now, it's interesting, you also can't create a tax rate that's progressive without a constitutional amendment. So what did the governor choose to do this year? He chose to create put on the ballot a vote on the Constitution being changed to allow a progressive tax rate, so you can have higher rates on higher earners. But did they also put the pension issue on? Because that's where the obligation is, that's forcing reductions in all the other states' spending, because they have people who double-dipped, and in the last 2-3 years of their working in a state job, took all the overtime so they'd get a percentage of their final year's pay into the future with 3% automatic cost of living adjustments. There's no state in the country that's given it away to municipal and state employees the way Illinois has, and now they want essentially the federal government to rescue them. There's no good reason for it to be done. I'm in Illinois.
And
I don't want to be bailed out by the rest of the country for the mistakes Illinois made.
No, and of course, the way they frame it, because I was watching one Democrat senator today saying that, well, we're talking about firemen, we're talking about nurses, we're talking about policemen. Well, if that's all they were talking about, I don't know of a single person in the other 49 states who wouldn't mind helping, because we understand, just as happened with 9/11, something like this puts a great financial strain on your first responders and all of that, and we're all for helping them. But pensions is a different topic. But apparently Connecticut is in the same boat.
Yeah, Kentucky is the one state that's not part of what I'll call the solid blue America that's a basket case for pensions. And I wasn't aware until I looked at the comparative chart that Kentucky was up there. It's not a particularly large state. But you've got states, you mentioned all the leading losers in this category. And some states have done better. You know, they have a reasonably high percentage of their obligations accounted for, and they can make their annual contributions without having to borrow to do it and putting the state further into hock. But there are 4 or 5 states that, if states were allowed to go bankrupt, that would actually be probably the easiest way for them to readjust their expenditures. So
right.
On an ongoing basis, when you didn't have crises like the virus to deal with, the states would have a chance of essentially paying their bills. Right now, every year in Illinois, they defer essentially Medicaid. Hospitals and nursing homes get paid by Medicaid 8-9 months delayed. I mean, basically, they just continue to add to accounts receivable for essentially the providers, because they don't have the money to pay them on a current basis. So,
right. No, it's crazy. Now, the only good news out of all of this, Richard, is that a Democrat governor is going to have to explain what you just explained to the public sector union.
Right.
That's the only good news.
What's funny is the governor of Illinois, J.B. Pritzker, was so embarrassed by the letter from the head of the state Senate that he distanced himself from it, because he realized it looked outrageous. Think about it. They're looking for $500 billion to give to the states, and Illinois wants 40 of it. Well,
right.
Illinois is 4% of the population of the country. They should get 8% of the money that's going to
right.
the states. Why?
Right. Well, but this is the kind of craziness that you're going to see. New York has similar problems too. Maybe not so much pensions, but New York has relied more and more on a smaller and smaller percentage of people paying taxes.
Right.
And they also rely a lot on the financial district, and that of course has suffered a great deal. But the point I just made a minute ago.
You're in Texas, and
yes.
Texas, Florida are getting people coming from all of the high tax states.
Exactly.
That are either insolvent or financially at risk, because they know that they're going to go after this small core because it's popular. If you tell the masses that you're only going to raise taxes on the top 1 or 2 or 3%, well, you pay your federal income tax, which is a 37% top rate, and then they keep raising the state rate, so the maximum rate becomes 11 and 12 and 13 and 15. And at some point, somebody looks at 15% versus zero, which is what they pay in Texas and Florida, and they
right.
got to ask, is that why? Why don't I
right.
spend 6 months and a day in those other places and become
well,
resident?
And that's exactly what's happening. I mean, a lot of our growth here is because of people, like you say, who move here. But politically, though, politically, and this is why I say to Democrats, be careful what you wish for, because if you have a Democrat president, he's going to have to tackle these issues too. And the public sector union, they're not going to be very happy when they hear that these cutbacks are coming. And there was a very interesting article that I wanted to ask you about. Maybe you saw this on CNBC. It came out yesterday, and that's what inspired me to do the show with you today. This article is basically calling for a downsizing, not calling for it, but basically reporting that we're going to be seeing a downsizing of the public sector in many of these states that we're talking about, where simply they cannot afford the obligations that they have. They simply can't. And, you know, whether they get money or don't get money, they simply cannot afford it. And they're just going to have to tell the public sector unions, look, I'm sorry, we're just going to have to renegotiate, or we're going to have to lay off people. And almost similar, Richard, to what happened in the private, with the private sector unions back in the 70s and 80s. When,
your point is exactly right, which is right now, public sector employees, by and large, with the same levels of education, out-earn people in the private sector. And so the question is, why? Is that right? Why do teachers in the public school system make more than teachers in the private school system? Why do essentially policemen or firemen or state employees or people who send out the tax bills have incomes higher, they say, than accountants that work in the private sector with a similar levels of education and experience? They do it because they have the ability to negotiate with themselves. That's what's different between the private sector, where you have management and you have labor, they have negotiations, they each protect their own interests. But there is no negotiation when you get to a state or a city where all of the elected officials have been elected with money contributed by the public employee unions.
Right.
They've gone exclusively to Democrats, and Democrats have to then feed those people who elected them. They can never produce. So you have essentially a non-negotiation. You have two parties that are on the same side politically that simply want to muddle their way through without offending the other. And
No, I'm just saying the public sector union, when they get the bad news, they're going to say, wait a minute, but we elected you.
Right.
And the Democrats are going to say, I know, that's the bad news. You elected us. Now we have to tell you the bad news. But
One other thing that's worth noting, by the way, the states you mentioned that have the biggest deficits essentially in their pension obligations and have the largest unfunded liability are also some of the most corrupt political states in the country.
Right.
And they actually go together. In Illinois, this was always a state where the people who had public jobs were essentially being rewarded for political activity, often on the job, historically. I mean, there was no attempt to even hide it during the years, for instance, in Chicago, during the first Daley administration. You didn't get to be a sanitation man unless you put in your time for the political party, for the machine. So this is kind of an overhang that created this relationship between the unions. And there were Democratic presidents, like Franklin Roosevelt said, it would be a huge mistake if we allow municipal unions to have the right to strike.
Mm-hmm.
And you see what you have now. Now they essentially have the states and the municipalities where they want them.
Right.
They have, you know, in the red states, sometimes you have conflicts, but in the blue states, basically they give it away.
Right. Well, I think here, of course, with the right to work, you know, the unions have to be more flexible. But we don't really have a public sector union problem down here. We have fights in the private sector, but that's okay.
Right.
Look, I have nothing. I've never had any problem with private sector unions because I want workers to get the best deal they can get. So
sure.
I have no problem with, you know, a private sector union.
All the money
should
go to Jeff Bezos, you know.
Exactly. So I have no problem with private sector unions saying, hey, we got to, you know, or union leaders in the private sector saying, hey, we want a bigger share of the pie. I'm okay with that in the private sector, but because, like you say, that's a little bit more balanced. But when you get into the public sector, it's real corruption. Let me ask you one more question. Maybe you know the answer.
Sure.
Could Illinois actually go into bankruptcy? Is that possible?
No, cities can, states can't. And one of the reasons McConnell is getting hammered now right and left, and not just on by Democrats, but also by some Republicans, Republican governors, is for sort of suggesting that maybe they should take that route too. But states can't unless you had essentially either legislation or potentially constitutional amendment. If it required a constitutional amendment, then it would never happen because you need the states to approve it. And right now the states would rather essentially avoid that because of the how badly that will play with their constituents. And it's usually embarrassing. But if it's just an act of Congress that requires it, that allows the change in the bankruptcy laws, which it may be, and I'm not an attorney, so I don't know this for sure, but if that's the case, you would need, obviously, to have one party probably in control of the White House and both branches of the legislature and support this. And I'm not sure that either party at this point does support it. But I think what McConnell was doing was simply saying, hey, don't come here for us to solve all your problems.
Right.
We don't have an unlimited amount of money.
No, I think you're right. I think that's the message he was sending. I did hear a potential solution that you could, in fact, bail out the pension in Illinois in exchange for breaking off or basically making it into two states, Chicago and the rest of the state.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that would be that's a crazy solution, but that's what I heard. You know, somebody was saying that, but I don't see how they're going to fix it. I mean, at some point, this is going to hit the wall, and my guess is that the public sector unions are going to have to step back a little bit because I have many friends in the Chicago area, and they tell me that they pay property taxes to support the pension.
Yeah. Oh, they're exorbitant. I mean, Illinois state income tax is 5%. I mean, it's not zero, but it's not the highest, among the major states. But property taxes are very high, sales taxes are very high, and there are all kinds of nuisance taxes. So overall, it's one of the highest tax states in the country, and it doesn't have the economic base of a New
That's
York,
the problem.
You know, which has media and finance and California, which has Silicon Valley. If we don't have that kind of industrial base here or have a particular industry that produces, all these billionaires who can get essentially taxed at exorbitant rates to help pay the bills. It's
right.
not going to happen. It doesn't happen.
No,
here.
It's not. I wonder sometimes if the governor of Illinois would have preferred that he had lost the election because this is not an easy job that he has walked into. I mean, it's an absolutely terrible job. Well, Richard, I want to thank you for your time and for the input. I like to maybe a few weeks down the road, as we know more about this, check with you again, because I think this is going to be, after we get through, the medical part of the virus and, putting the economy at least on a winning track, I think this is the big issue. I really do. In 2021,
yeah.
It could also be a big issue in the election as Biden is forced to either defend the public sector unions or not defend him, and I don't see him winning either way. On that topic.
I'll give you, by the way, what I think is Trump's secret issue. I don't know, secret issue, but an issue that's going to become a bigger and bigger deal if he runs against Biden and Biden's, actually is the nominee despite, what looked like some of his mental failings at this point, and that's China. Because Biden has been in the camp of those who wanted to play ball with China for really the last 30 or 40 years, and a lot of Americans are unhappy that the suffering that people are going through now was caused to a significant extent because of the behavior and the dishonesty of China. And being able to put him on the spot, essentially, for a lot of the things he said could be a real important issue for Trump to make this appear to be, are you with America or are you with China? And Biden is going to have to get prepared for that because he has a record and of having said things which are really almost embarrassing on the subject.
Yeah, well, if I know anything about Trump, and remember, I was on the other side in 2016, meaning I was supporting people running against Trump.
Sure.
So I got a taste of what it was like to run against Trump, and sure. Trump plays to win. I mean, that's
yeah,
it.
No,
he
I,
plays
I,
to win.
I,
and he's not a, you know, he's not, he's going to go
first.
Hard against Biden. I remember how he went against, you know, not just Ted Cruz, but Marco Rubio and some of the others that we were supporting. I mean, he went
Bush.
Very hard. The other thing, too, I wanted to ask you a couple of very quick questions because I've been trying to get the answer. Has former Vice President Biden actually come out against the immigration ban, not the ban, but the, basically the 60-day ban that President Trump imposed? Has he actually said anything
about it? I have actually
not
I have not seen any statement on it, which doesn't mean he didn't make it. But the news sources that I look at during the day, that one did not pop up if he did make a statement. And my guess is his people might be trying to be careful about this because they may think they have a winning issue with the economy in shambles and they'll blame Bush for the bad response. They understand that some of the other issues, Trump may have a stronger hand at this point, and immigration doesn't look that attractive with 26 million people out of work.
Right, exactly. And the other issue, too, that apparently he was backtracking on was fracking. Remember, he was against fracking in the debates, and now apparently he's backing away because, of course, that's a big issue in Pennsylvania. So that's one of the problems with Joe Biden. I mean, I personally like the guy. I mean, of all the Democrats that we have had over the last 40 years, he's probably one of the nicest guys who has ever been around. But I just don't think he's a very good candidate. And I think if you put him in a debate with Trump, he's going to look very bad. That's all I can say.
I mean, Biden does well in polls now, but what really people are voting for is not Trump. Not for Biden, but not Trump. And, you know, that becomes a clearer choice, actually, between two people once you have the candidates formally nominated and you have the election campaign and you have the vice presidential candidates picked.
Right.
And in 6 months, we'll see how Biden holds up and whether he can essentially be articulate enough for people not to get overly concerned about whether he can handle the job.
That's right. Well, in 6 months, I hope to talk to you about the World Series also. So hopefully we'll have that to talk about as well. But I want to thank you very much for your time. Have a wonderful day. I hope you and your wife stay safe. And we'll
you. Always great to talk to you.
Same here. And you have a wonderful day.
Thanks a lot, Silvio.
Thank you so much. We're going to take a little break, and we'll be back right after this. Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas. Again, Richard Baer, we want to thank him for joining us today. He's a co-founder of American Thinker, and I'm very fortunate to post at American Thinker, and I know many of you follow that website. It's certainly one of the best in the country for a lot of good independent thinking and just an absolutely great website. But I will say one thing before we go. I really believe this is going to be a big issue come fall. That is the future of many of these states. And I'm not talking about every blue state, but I'm talking about Illinois, New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut. Illinois and Connecticut are in very bad shape. Had nothing to do with the flu. Had to do with policies before, economic policies. New York as well. And these states, I think, are going to want to somehow get bailed out by the money that is going to be actually be invested in what they like to call infrastructure and all of that. And I don't have a problem. I mean, certainly firemen and health resources and all of that, medical resources, yeah, we need to help them in respect to that. But we shouldn't be bailing out under any circumstances the kind of malpractice, and that's what it is, economic malpractice that we have seen in so many of these states. So we'll see how it goes, but I really believe that this is going to be a big issue in the election, because I think former Vice President Biden is going to be forced to speak about this. And I think a lot of other Democrats running for election are also going to be forced to speak about this. And I don't think the country right now is in the mood of bailing out states who have mismanaged their economies. They don't mind. I mean, I can speak for myself as a Republican. I don't have a problem helping these states with doctors and nurses and medical expenses and all of that brought about by the coronavirus. I have no problem doing that. But when you start getting into bailing out their pension plans and bailing out basically the public sector unions in many of these states, I think these states are going to have a very difficult problem. And I think they're going to find that Trump is going to be a pretty tough negotiator when it comes to any of that. Well, thank you for listening. Again, our thanks to our friend Richard Baer, co-founder of The American Thinker. And he writes over at The American Thinker from time to time. And check out The American Thinker. It's a great website. Lots of good information on that site. Thank you for listening. Have a wonderful day. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas.